It's the sixth book of the Bible. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. After 3 days, the officers went throughout the camp, giving orders to the people. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, and the priests who are Levites carrying it, you are to move out from your positions and follow it. Then you will know which way to go, since you have never been this way before. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the ark. Do not go near it. Joshua told the people, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you." Joshua said to the priests, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on ahead of the people." So they took it up and went ahead of them. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so they may know that I am with you as I was with Jordan. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." Joshua said to the Israelites, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap." So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up into a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarathan. While the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan, while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. Amen. This is the word of the living God. Again, in Joshua chapter 3, Joshua 3, verse 4. "Then you will know which way to go, since you have never been this way before. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the ark. Do not go near it." These words, "since you have never been this way before." Now, the River Jordan today is not all that wide. It's not all that big. In fact, those of you who were with the church group in Israel last year crossed over the Jordan, but you probably weren't aware that you were crossing over the Jordan, because it is little more than a ditch these days. Certain things have happened and the water just is not flowing. Times have changed in the last 2,000-3,000 years' time. But in fact, in its heyday, the River Jordan was never really all that wide. At its greatest width, I think it was 45 yards wide. Of course, at the time of the floods, and we're seeing that here, the harvest floods in Joshua chapter 3, it was very, very strong. But still, the river itself was no great barrier physically. It was, however, a great barrier psychologically, and it was a great barrier spiritually, and we'll see the reason for that later on. So most of you know what's happening here, but just a very, very brief recap. The children of Israel had been redeemed from Egypt. They had been having a really tough time there. They were suffering through oppression and heavy labor. And God, of course, redeemed them, and that story is told in the Exodus. And they have to go through the wilderness, and they make one or two mistakes, and as a punishment for that, they are wandering through the wilderness for 40 years. And of course, you've got 2.5 million people. So it's a huge logistic exercise. I don't think folk realize, you know, how massive this was. 2.5 million people is a significant amount of folk to move through the desert. So here they are after 40 years, after eating the same thing, day in, day night, after following this great vision that God had given them, following the fire by night and the cloud by day. At last they come to the borders of the promised land, and they find here is the River Jordan. Just think for a moment in the introduction, these words, the promised land. The promised land. These words are so evocative, aren't they? Poets have been inspired by them. Politicians really have been gripped by that. Remember Martin Luther King's last speech in Memphis before he was assassinated. I have been to the mountaintop and I have seen the promised land. And he gave there one of his most powerful speeches that he'd ever given. He saw this tantalizing vision of the promised land of racial equality in the United States. And then we've got the boss himself, Bruce Springsteen. He's got a song called The Promised Land. And it's about a mechanic in Virginia. And the mechanic in Virginia wants to go to California, which is the promised land. Our American friends have got big visions, haven't they? That the journey from Virginia to California is indeed the promised land. And Springsteen writes, the dogs in Main Street howl because they understand. If I could take one moment in my hands, mister, I ain't a boy, no, I'm a man, and I believe in a promised land. And so as we saw this morning, many folk from the world's perspective see the promised land as being fulfilled in this life. They see the promised land as political idealism, as Martin Luther King saw it. Or they see the promised land as a land of riches, as Springsteen's Virginian mechanic saw it. But what for us is the promised land? Well, if we take the redemptive flow of the Bible from Genesis right through to Revelation, there is this constant theme of the promised land. The fallen Garden of Eden is replaced by the magnificent, perfect Garden of Heaven. The fall at Eden is replaced by the rise of heaven, the great catastrophe in Genesis is matched by the great triumph of the book of Revelation when the people of God come indeed to the promised land. And so many of these tremendous African-American spiritualists speak of the promised land. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. And these people kept going through oppression in the cotton fields of the South. They kept going with this idea that there was a better land and a better land to come. So we've got two big images, haven't we, in Joshua chapter 3. We've got the image of the Jordan River, and that's so, again, evocative. Folks speak of the Jordan as death, don't they? They speak of, you know, passing over to the other side. And we can see how it so clearly matches up to the expectation of death and the promised land on the other side. So there's the image of the River Jordan there, and there's the image of the promised land. What I want to do is look at the chapter this evening, and we want to notice three things. Old school tonight. Three things. And the first thing we notice here is the prospect God promised. The prospect God promised. One thing that keeps Christians going is the thing that kept Christians going then. That when they were being oppressed, a whole generation was in the desert, and they held on to this view that there would be a better day. Remember, God met Moses, Joshua's predecessor. God met Moses at the burning bush and said, I'm going to lead you into a land flowing with milk and honey, a good and spacious land. Moses died before they got there. Joshua took over, but there was this prospect that God had promised. Now, what God promises doesn't come immediately. 40 years, and then look at verse 1. It said there where they camped before crossing over. The commentaries I read say that they camped for maybe a few days there. It was not an immediate thing. God's timing is not the same as our timing. We are people of immediacy. We want things instantly. And that's what we expect. And we live in an age that expects things to be done just like that. We don't like waiting for anything. I have not traveled in a bus, to my shame. But when I was waiting in a bus on Thursday at the bus stop in Smithton to take me into the town, two things struck me. One, it cost £2.10. I thought buses still cost 40 pence the last time I was in a bus. But the second thing was waiting, just this sense of waiting. You know, why am I waiting so long for a bus? Why is public transport so inefficient? Now, I was only waiting 4 minutes. But there was this, we've been trained to get everything immediately. And we're like that with God. We want things to be done now. And we're an impatient people. We don't realize that things take time. And here, there is a further 3 days. Verse 1 alludes to that. Yes, there is a prospect, but we've got to wait for it. And waiting exercises patience. And patience can also be defined as faith. And so some of us are perhaps in a waiting period in our own lives just now. And maybe they waited. Other commentators say that they were struck by the enormity of the task. Remember, it wasn't just the physical barrier, but it was a new thing over on the other side. People they didn't know, situations that they would have to confront, a new culture, battles that they had to fight. It was a new thing in their experience. They'd never been, as we said in verse 4, that way before. It was a psychological battle. They'd heard that there were giants in the land. And again, for us, we experience similar things in our own lives. I wonder how many of you love going in. You know, let me put this scenario. You're going to some sort of party or some function at night. It's a room full of people you have never met before. And you are walking into that room on your own. Now, I don't know many folk in this room who would say, David, I love that situation. I love walking on my own into a room full of people I have never met in my entire life. And I just love going up to them and say, hi, I'm David, who are you? Pleased to meet you. I don't think we've ever met before. It is a living nightmare. New things are. New things stress us. These are 2.5 million people. And we see them there. That's why it's mentioned there, the weird names in verse 10, the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. Actually, they were all forms of Canaanites. Canaanite is a big word, and all these people were subsections. Jebusites, for example, were folk who lived around Jerusalem. Now, I think that the 2.5 million were just like we are. They wanted the promised land, but they didn't want to cross the Jordan. They wanted the land flowing with milk and honey, but they didn't want to go through the difficulties of a fast-flowing river. And again, many of us are exactly like that. New things require us to break through, but we are comfortable. Notice that phrase in verse 3. It's a little phrase, but it's so instructive. You are to move out from your positions and follow it. For many of us, that's a nightmare scenario. You are to move out of your positions and follow it. You are to move out of your particular comfort zones, and you are to follow that particular thing, the prospect that God has promised. Now, you are in the wilderness, but you've got used to it. You've been there for 40 years. You've kind of got used to manna and quail every day. It's kind of the way things are. But God's saying, look, there is more. The new way seems to be scary. Tomorrow seems to fill us with dread. But yet we have here, for the people of God, always there is the prospect that God promised. There is growing in grace. There is heaven at the end. But there are many Jordans to be faced. And so the difficulties in your life, in my life, are not suggesting that we're on the wrong track. They are suggesting that we are on exactly the right track. The prospect God promised. But notice, secondly, the power that God revealed. One thing that struck me about this chapter, indeed many things struck me, but one thing in particular is that it's just God-obsessed. It's God-saturated, isn't it? It's dominated by God. You see that, for example, in verse 3. It says this, when you see the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God and the priests or Levites carrying it, you're to move out from your positions and you are to follow it. In the next two chapters, the Ark of the Covenant is mentioned 17 times. Now, the Ark of the Covenant, as you all know, was a symbol of God's presence with his people. The law was in the Ark. There was all these symbols of who God was. It was a kind of visual aid, a living embodiment, or an embodiment of who God was. And so they knew that when they crossed the Jordan, the story was that when the high priest dipped their toe in the water, the waters of the Jordan would stop and they would pile up and a passageway would be made clear and the people of God would walk over. It was God who was going to stop the Jordan River, and the power of God is seen there. Now, I think there's a phrase there that interests me. Look at verse 4. It says, then you will know which way to go, since you have never been this way before. But this is a phrase that interested me. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between you and the ark. Do not go near it. Now, that's about 3/4 of a mile. That's about 800 meters in new money. You have to stay behind the ark. Now, I look at these passages and it puzzles me. Why was that? At first I thought, well, it was a holiness thing, you know, because the Ark of the Covenant was so holy, the people weren't to go near it, they were to stay away. There was a sense of the awe of God. We know that when a guy called Uzzah touched the Ark, he was struck down. So there's a holiness issue. But it seems to me that this was much, much more than that. I think folks say that faith requires bifocals. An old Methodist preacher who's now dead called Donald English, and he speaks about faith having trifocals. And I think here what's happening is that God is putting the ark so far ahead to give the people perspective. To give the people a long perspective so that they know where they are going and they can look around to the side. And so the idea here, and many of the commentators are saying exactly the same, the ark was 800 meters there so as the folk could look before, so as the folk could look behind, so as the folk could look to the side. Donald English says, you know, that faith is like a rowing crew, that kind of Oxbridge illustration, but you know, the Cambridge, Oxford boat race, where you've got the oarsman, the stroking oarsman can see the distance that has been covered. The cocks at the front are seeing the distance to be covered, and there's people in the middle who can see the dangers at the side. And so the point of the ark there is to give us perspective, to give us God's perspective, to know that ultimately God is before us. And so we need perspective. So many of us are wrapped up within ourselves. In any situation, a business or a church, or even personally, it's good to adopt what sort of business strategists used to call helicopter vision. Coming above a situation and looking all around. And that's why the ark was so far ahead, to give the people of Israel that helicopter vision. One preacher, Richard Bues, preaching on this passage, gives the example of, say, someone who has been a Christian for a long, long time. And you say to them, you know, do you remember what it was like before you were a Christian? And they say, oh, no. So, for example, they look at young folk and they say, oh, tut, tut. They judge young folk for the way they're behaving, and yet they forget that they were once young, that they once had energy, that they once had the sort of mindset to boldly go where no man had gone before, that they once split infinitives, that they once didn't get everything perfect. And so we've got to get that perspective. Yes, we've got to see God in front of us, but we've got to see around us as well, that it's not all about us, that it's not all about our view of things. You can apply that in various ways. You can apply it to church life. If we all were so angry because church wasn't made in our image, then it would be really desperate, because we all have particular likes and dislikes in churches, for example. Some of us like church like that, and some of us like church like that, and some of us, we've got all sorts of ideas. But perspective is so important. We see God ahead of us, we see the terrain around us, and we see the people of God with us. But if we want to see God at work, look at verse 5. Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. Consecrate yourselves. Now, this is a recurring pattern. Whenever God was going to do something in the Bible, quite often he said to the people, consecrate yourselves, prepare yourselves. Exodus 19, 10 and 14, same expression. Numbers 11, 18, consecrate yourselves. Now, in the Old Testament, it could be something outward, like washing your clothes. Refraining from certain things could be your practice. It could be confessing sins. In other words, our attitude has to be right. Consecrate yourselves. Prepare yourselves to meet God. Prepare for the miraculous. Now, we in ourselves cannot effect the miraculous. We cannot do miraculous things. It's a sovereign God issue. But we can consecrate ourselves. We can confess our sins. We can come before God and honestly meet with him and pour out all our hearts and our inadequacies and our failures. These people were about to meet God. In this service, we are meeting God. How many of us consecrated ourselves? How many of us prepared for coming this evening? You wouldn't expect someone to lead the service to simply saunter up, not having a clue not having a clue if there was a beginning, a middle, or an end. You wouldn't expect the preacher to come unprepared, just kind of waffling on. Maybe you think that's exactly what I do. But hopefully there is a hint of preparation. We know where we're going. Yeah, you would be angry if the preacher didn't prepare. But hasn't the congregation to prepare for the service? Haven't we got to pray for the preacher? Haven't we got to pray for the worship? Haven't we got to pray for one another? And we come with this sense of expectancy that God's going to do a miracle, that God's going to change our life, that God's going to give us a new perspective, that God's going to speak to us in an incredibly powerful way. That's how churches are exciting places. Folks, I wish that we'd fitted seatbelts to these chairs because we're exposed to so much excitement, because that's what the Bible is all about. But we may say, oh, never. Are we consecrated people coming to God, asking that he will fill us, coming to God, knowing that if we seek him, that we will find him? Yes, here we have this idea. But what are we looking at? The power of God revealed, and we're seeing it in so many ways there. Look how God is revealed. Look how he's spoken of, rather. Verse 10. This is how you will know that the living God is among you. Great missionary book. So great. The title, I had the title 10 seconds ago, but in a flow of eloquence, it went out. Killing Fields, Living Fields, about the Cambodian mission outreach there. And the author there speaks of going into a house in Cambodia and being broken because on the mantelpiece of the house there were shelving full of gods. So Pol Pot was doing his worst all around them. The Killing Fields were fully operational, 40 years ago. And all these people had were sticks in the mantelpiece. Contrast that with Jehovah. He is the living God. And he's known there again. Look at the other phrase that's used of God. The Lord of all the earth. Do you see that in verse 11? That backs up what we saw 2 weeks ago when we were looking at Rahab, the pagan. He is the Lord of all the earth. We are Christians not just because we were born and bred in the United Kingdom or wherever else we were born or bred. He is not just a God who is, you know, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant God, a WASP. He is a God who claims universal sovereignty. He's the God of all the earth. And again, look at verse 18. This is such a... you wouldn't look at verse 18 because verse 18 doesn't exist. So if you find it, you'll be doing really, really well. We've got that... Oh yeah, verse 10 it is. This is how you will know that the living God is among you. The word know there, this is how you will know that the living God is among you. The Hebrew word there is not an intellectual knowledge. It's a spine-tingling, hair-raising experience. You will know that God is among you. You will experience him. You will feel his presence. The hair on the back of your heads will stand up. Your spines will tingle in his presence. One theologian called Otto says, in the knowledge of the holy, you will have goosebumps. They weren't going to lecture. I was reading on Friday in the Scientific American, which I don't normally get. Again, I was reading it online. And I read this. This article said, it might be time in our own day to pencil in awe cultivation on your to-do list. He speaks about religious thinkers like Kierkegaard. He said that awe is an existential state of fear and trembling. But he says this, research by psychologists at Stanford and the University of Minnesota shows that that experiencing awe can actually increase well-being. Now, that's so typically today. That the experience of awe is for our well-being. Isn't that so man-centered? But where these Stanford dudes have it right is that there is this need in our own life for knowing the Holy, knowing God. And then amongst all the nonsense of the article, he says this is what we need. For the wrong reasons, but he's got the right concept. He's saying this is awe, quote, triggered by some experience so expansive that one's mental schemas have to be adjusted in order to process it. That's what awe is. Faced with a situation so expansive that one's mental schemas have to be adjusted. The parameters don't fit. The wiring cannot cope with this sense of the holiness of God, the awe of God, the majesty of God, the fact that this is a God of the whole earth. And he has made it so that if the priests dip their feet in the water, the rivers stop. And 2.5 million people cross over into the promised land. So what? God is not merely a three-letter word in Christian jargon. He is the Holy One with whom we have to do business. He is a God whom we worship. He is a God whom we love with all our heart, mind, and strength. He is a God who is so huge that we cannot even look upon him. He's not a minor league deity. The power God revealed. And this is also, I think, a Romans 8:32 hint. You know that if God has done this comparably little thing in his eyes, hold back the Jordan River, how much more will he do great things for us? The God who can handle the great can handle the small. In Uganda, when we were there, 10 days, my biggest problem wasn't the Ugandan military, and they were mean dudes. My major problem wasn't the food or the water. My main problem wasn't even having to live with 10 members of this congregation for 10 days, and they having to live with me. My main problem were little things I couldn't even see, mosquitoes. Someone who says to you, the small things in life don't matter, have never been bitten by a mosquito. It's the small things often. And this passage tells us, if God can handle the comparatively small things in his sight of stopping the Jordan River, he can handle anything. Are you worried about a small thing tonight? The prospect God promised, the power God revealed. Thirdly, and very briefly, we notice here the person God used. Look at verse 7. And the Lord said to Joshua, Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Now, look at 4:14. God was as good as his word that day. Next chapter, 4:14. That day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. Leadership is so important, but again, it's not the leadership of man. It is the leadership of a man anointed by God with God behind him. The person God used. Leadership. God anointed leadership. Leadership in the church does not come from gifts of leadership. It does not come from being reading, is it Drucker or one of these management gurus, or reading Alex Ferguson's great book on management, Good As It Is. Yes, there are things that we can learn about leadership. There are things we can learn about leadership. But there's nothing worse than poor leadership. And you find here that the people of God needed and demanded strong leadership at this point. And God knows that. That's why God exalts Joshua in the eyes of all the Israelites, so that they know that there's a leader with a vision, a leader who's taking them places. I'm reading a little bit about World War I at the moment. And Admiral Haig, the Haig Poppy Fund, was an absolutely terrible military General Haig, a terrible military leader. He was largely responsible for the Somme, and he was utterly, utterly out of touch. Haig was an English country gentleman. An English country gentleman ride horses. Haig was obsessed with horses. He thought horses were the ultimate fighting machine. And he poo-pooed this idea of German with their tanks. Good old horse will do it any day. So he sent the horses over the top. You've all seen the war horse. Absolute disaster of a leader. Indeed, Paul Fussell, in his indispensable volume, The Great War in Modern Memory, he says this: in a situation demanding the military equivalent of wit and invention, Haig had none. No leadership. And here we see Joshua is given by God this ability to take the people on. So Joshua led the people. Now, with this I close. He led the people over the Jordan. And this is very intriguing. At the worst possible time of the year. We read there that the water was flowing during the harvest. It was at its highest height. It really was flooding. And we've got this frustrating, look at verse 15. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet, as soon as the priests who carried out reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. What we have here is, from verse, 9 downwards, we've got a description of the people of God moving towards the edge of the Jordan, and just, it's like watching a film on TV. Just as you get to the big point, an advert comes on for cornflakes or something like that. That's what you get here. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them, and you're waiting for it. Now, the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. It's kind of like that, isn't it? It's a frustrating parenthesis. But the climax comes in verse 16. The water from upstream stopped flowing. They crossed the Jordan, and salvation for the people of God was accomplished. Who else crossed the Jordan? Jesus crossed the Jordan. Jesus did not just cross the Jordan. Jesus was baptized in the Jordan. And when he came out of the Jordan, having received that affirmation from his Father, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased," he set off to accomplish redemption for his people. The ultimate Jordan crosser is Jesus. The ultimate redemption is Christian redemption. The ultimate salvation is salvation from our sins. The ultimate promised land is not a racially free world, and that is a good thing. It is not the wealth and prosperity of California, whether it's California just outside Falkirk or California in America. That is not what we're looking for. We cross the Jordan attached to Jesus. Jesus has made the crossing of our Jordan possible. That is why the old hymn says, "Our anxious fears subside at the river." There is an application here of death itself. That when we come to that Jordan River, it will not consume us. We will cross over to the other side. And as Bunyan says, the trumpets will sound. Why did God do it at the toughest time? Why did God do it when the floods were at their fullest? Because he wanted to show his might in the face of our powerlessness, so that we may know, Psalm 121 verse 2, so that we may know that our help comes from the Maker of heaven and earth. The prospect God promised, the power God revealed, the person God used, is tomorrow a way you have never been before. Dip your toe in that river and watch God do what God does. Father, we bow in your presence again, thanking you for who you are. Thanking you that you are King of Kings and Lord of Lords. For many of us, the week ahead is a way we've never seen. But thank you that you are the God of Inverness, the God of Rossshire, the God of Scotland, the God of the United Kingdom, the God of Europe, the God of the world, the God of all the earth. Help us to praise you and magnify you. Amen.